There was a tendency, or there can be a tendency, I think, to reduce a lot of what we read in the Bible to merely symbolic language. Not to see it as something that actually occurred, but rather to see it as something that simply helps us to understand what awaits us at some future time. This can be done with the miracles we read both in the Old and in the New Testament. It can be done when we see certain events in the gospel, like Jesus multiplying the loaves and fishes to feed thousands from food that was only enough for a few. And sadly, we can even have, in some circles, this understanding of the resurrection of Jesus. That it really wasn't an historical event, claim some, but simply a symbolic one. But if we have any temptation to believe in something like that, then we need only to read the second reading of St. Paul. Paul makes it abundantly clear that this can't simply be a symbolic event, for if it were not to be historical, then indeed everything we place our hopes on is wrong. It's worthless. It does not count. And that makes us the saddest of all if it is not historically true. Now, if you have been to the magnificent basilica that we have here, the Cathedral Basilica, just a short distance from where we are now, you've seen this verse, and you've seen that it is one of those that is important to single out. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is in vain. It's that simple. And there are all kinds of explanations that demonstrate the historicity of the resurrection. Probably most well known among those who look at such things, the work of Peter Kraft, who looks at explanations that have been given or could be given, that Jesus merely fainted but wasn't really dead, or that his disciples concocted this scheme to convince others, or whatever. But the reality is that none of those hand up when we think of the scrutiny that they deserve. And perhaps most of all, because those closest to the event gave their lives for its truth. What is it that we are willing to do for our faith? What is it that we are willing to do because we do believe that Jesus is risen from the dead and gives us then, because of this, such a tremendous message that everything we have is placed on the hope that this resurrection forgives our sins and confirms that Jesus has offered his love and his life and his body in sacrifice to pay the debt that we owe because of our sin. In fact, this is the great good news, that because of our sinfulness, we could have been condemned, but because of the love of God, we are not. Because of the gift of Jesus, Jesus has paid the price for our sinfulness so that we can live this great and wonderful and new life. And if there are people who need to hear this message, St. Luke in the Gospel tells us that this message is most needed by those who suffer most in this world. Luke's version of the Beatitudes are dramatically different from Matthew's. Matthew is writing to a more well-to-do community, and so he's encouraging people that in fact have some means what it means to live in that way. So they are not poor. And so they must think and live and act as if they were. For Luke, the community is in fact poor. And the community of believers that he has seen becoming attracted to Jesus is that community who, because of their trust in God, which is necessitated by their poverty, it is the poor who are blessed. It is those who are hungry and trust in Jesus who discover that he can satisfy their hunger. It is those who suffer so desperately because they have so little control in their lives. They experience so many difficult and challenging things that they can receive the joy and the laughter and the good news of the gospel. And Luke then says this, that we need to be careful because if our trust is first placed on things that we ourselves have, the things that we ourselves control, then we are not saved. If we trust in our possessions but not in God, we are not saved. If we trust in those things that console us today and not in God, we are not saved. If it is, in fact, that we laugh to the point where we cannot embrace and feel empathy for those who suffer, then, in fact, we are not saved. That is the message of the gospel, that our salvation comes because we trust in the Lord. Our salvation comes because we recognize that our faith is placed first in Jesus. That's the message that Jeremiah is trying to convince the people in the first reading is one that is true. Jeremiah was known as the weeping prophet because next to nothing that he said was really embraced by people who heard him speak. And this made him so sad. The fact that God was being ignored, that the promise was not being embraced, made him ever so sad because of what he knew would happen to the people if they turned their back on God. Cursed, he said, is the one who trusts in human beings, who seeks his strength in flesh. I don't know about you, but the temptation that I probably struggle with the most is this one: trusting in myself, having difficulty to trust in God. Because the world is so difficult, and it just seems that perhaps it would be better if I just placed my trust in myself, because at least I'd have no one else to blame. But Jeremiah says that makes things worse. And of course it does. I can't really fix much in the world. When I rely only on myself, there is not much that I can make a great deal better. I can't feed the majority of people who are starving in the world. I can help some, but not most. I cannot, of my own accord, make the world a peaceful place. Not only the world, I have a hard enough time making the little group of people with whom I live sometimes to live in peace. I need God's grace, and so do you. Ask the Lord today that you might recognize that it is in our brokenness, it is in our sadness, it is in our suffering that we most can see the action and activity of God in our own lives, for it is in those things that help us to recognize that God indeed is the one who is worthy of all our trust.